ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Now, I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder exactly, but I do hang on to things. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? Come and have a rummage through the story of us, told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. If you happen to be wandering through just the right corridor of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City on the 18th of September 2013, you would have seen quite a bizarre sight. Two high-ranking American diplomats desperately trying to rip a framed photograph off the wall. The officials were these two men.
Bill Burns is someone who has worked on the Iran issue for several years. Jake Sullivan is someone who is really widely respected at the White House and at the State Department.
They would later go on to become CIA director and national security advisor in the Biden administration. But at this particular moment, their main concern was getting this picture off the wall. Outside, the streets of New York were filled with protests against the Iranian regime. They were there to denounce the new president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani.
This man, Rouhani, has an enormous amount of blood on his hands.
There is no chance that the regime is going to give up its quest for nuclear weapons.
But secretly, there at the Waldorf Astoria, Burns and Sullivan were set to meet with Rouhani's advisors and try and convince them to do just that. To get the Iranian regime to give up its quest for nuclear weapons. The trouble was, just as the advisors arrived, the Americans realized that on the wall outside their meeting room was a giant photograph of the last Shah of Iran visiting the Waldorf in the 1970s. A giant image of the man the Iranian regime hated more than any other person on Earth. The man they had overthrown in 1979. Seeing his picture next to the meeting room could seriously offend them. Burns and Sullivan, in a panic, began tugging at the frame, only to find that it had been bolted to the wall. The relevant question here is, why did they care? Why were they worried about offending the Iranians? It's certainly not something that the Trump administration is worried about, as they attempt to find a way to extricate themselves from the war they gleefully joined in February of this year.
They're animals. And we have to stop them, and we can't let them have a nuclear weapon.
Back in 2013, Burns and Sullivan were able to strike a deal with the Iranian regime that, in terms of substance, is probably pretty similar to the deal the Trump administration will be trying to get Iran to agree to this time. So today, I want to take a look at the similarities and differences between what happened in 2013 and what's happening now. I think it's going to tell us a lot about how difficult the process of finding peace will be in the next few weeks and months. I'm Matt Bevan, and this is If You're Listening. Okay. For a lot of this story, we're going to be talking about William Burns, one of these two guys who were trying to rip that picture off the wall that day in the Waldorf Astoria in New York. Burns is like an archetypal diplomat, softly spoken. He's got grey hair and a little moustache, educated at Oxford.
I took the written exam for the Foreign Service at our old embassy in London the same week as our diplomats in Tehran were taken hostage.
That incident, the storming of the American embassy in Tehran in 1979, ended diplomatic relations between the US and Iran. Over the next three decades of Burns's career, the two countries only spoke through intermediaries, like schoolchildren having an argument. Switzerland, can you tell Iran that we're very mad at them? Pakistan, can you please tell the US that we don't care, and also that they have Western decadent cooties? When two countries don't have diplomatic relations, trust is very difficult to build. And it was rendered even more difficult because throughout the George W. Bush administration and into the first term of the Obama administration, Iran was building up its capacity to enrich uranium, a process which could lead to Iran having nuclear weapons. The Americans really wanted Iran to stop doing that, so they imposed trade sanctions to increase the economic pressure on Iran.
A significant regime of sanctions that will indicate to them how isolated they are from the international community as a whole.
These sanctions seriously restricted Iran's ability to export oil, which was bad news for Iran because exporting oil is the way that Iran makes its money. And so the impacts rippled through the entire country.
This is not a profession about talking nicely to people. You got to build up leverage.
The problem was that without diplomatic relations between Iran and the US, there was no way for the two countries to actually negotiate. Even if the US could find someone to talk to, how could they trust that that person was really in a position to strike a deal? But that started to shift in 2009, when something interesting happened.
Some of you may remember the incident where there were three young American hikers who were on the Iraqi-Iran border, not the place I would have chosen to hike.
Three American hikers accidentally wandered into Iran.
The backpackers crossed the poorly marked border by mistake.
Unfortunately for the hikers, one does not simply walk into Iran, or at least one does not do it without getting arrested.
Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatal, and Sarah Short have been held for 3 weeks. They entered Iran from Iraq without authorization July 31st.
The usual intermediaries were unable to convince Iran to release these hikers. But fortunately, a new player entered the chat.
This is Oman, a small but rich oil-producing country in the Middle East.
Oman is a bit of an enigma of a country. At the time, it was ruled by Sultan Qaboos, who was a bit of an enigma himself.
His Majesty Sultan Qaboos bin Said al-Said, graduate of Sandhurst, absolute ruler of his people, and fan of Gilbert and Sullivan.
On top of being a modernizer and diplomat, he was a patron of classical music, employing a royal orchestra, playing the flute himself, and building venues for classical music across the country.
Two of his palaces have maybe up there in the top 10 concert halls in the world.
Everyone was a fan of Sultan Qaboos, largely because his geopolitical strategy was to be incredibly friendly.
Oman never cut off diplomatic relations with any government in the world. He used his friends of all, enemies of no one foreign policy to position Muscat as a very important diplomatic bridge.
And it was this friendly foreign policy position that saw Oman successfully get these American hikers released when all other countries had failed.
We will always be grateful to His Majesty, Sultan Qaboos bin Said of Oman, for his work to secure our release.
This made a big impression on the Americans.
The Omanis proved very resourceful in helping us to obtain their release, so that's how they established their credibility.
So when Sultan Qaboos called and said that he might be able to convince the Iranians to meet secretly with American diplomats to discuss their nuclear weapons program, the Americans were very interested.
I vividly remember the first trip we made to Oman in an unmarked U.S. government aircraft leaving Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington, 17-hour flight to Oman.
Burns and his colleague Jake Sullivan were sent to head up the negotiations, partially because they weren't well known. Burns says that President Obama sent them on their way with some important advice.
Well, you guys know what we need to do. I trust you, so don't screw it up. May have actually been a little bit more colorful than don't screw it up.
Both sides thought that public negotiations would turn into a political circus, which is why they were very keen to do things in private.
I don't think we would have gotten very far if we had done this in the glare of publicity.
They wanted to see if they could reach common ground before anyone found out about it. So when Burns and Sullivan landed in Oman, they got straight to business.
We meet in this vacated Omani military officers retreat right on the Arabian Sea. The temperature outside was about 120 degrees Fahrenheit, so there wasn't much to do other than talk to the Iranians.
The man they were meeting was Abbas al-Araghchi, a prominent spokesperson for the Iranian Foreign Ministry, who was publicly hopeful that discussions with the West might lead to a solution.
I think what we need is goodwill and a real willingness and determination to resolve these differences and to bridge these differences.
Like Burns, Araghchi was educated in England, so his ability to negotiate with the Americans in English made the whole process much easier.
I believe a solution is at our reach. What we need is only good faith.
They had several secret meetings in Oman, followed by more secret meetings in New York during the UN General Assembly in September 2013.
I do believe that if we can resolve the issue of Iran's nuclear program, that can serve as a major step down a long road towards a different relationship.
Despite their progress, Burns and Sullivan couldn't get Barack Obama and Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, into the same room together.
This lunch might have offered the opportunity, but President Rouhani didn't show.
But someone who seemed like he was important gave Sullivan Rouhani's phone number. Sullivan says he set up a call between Rouhani and Obama, but realised as the phone was ringing that it might not actually be Rouhani's number. He had just been given it by some random Iranian guy.
And I have a thought. Have I just connected the president to, like, a Canadian shock jock or some random other person? Or is this actually the president of Iran?
Thankfully, for Sullivan, it was the real guy.
Just now, I spoke on the phone with President Rouhani of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Throughout this years-long involved and occasionally bizarre process, the US and Iran built up enough trust to be able to find a way to work together. And in 2015, after 2 years of good faith negotiations, the two nations finally came to an agreement.
Iran agreed to limit its disputed nuclear program in exchange for some relief from tough sanctions.
Well, there was actually one more caveat. The deal apparently couldn't be signed until after the Iranian delegation went on a Sound of Music sing-along bus tour across Austria.
Which involved, like, the bus, like, playing the songs from The Sound of Music while they drove around to, like, the key sites from the movie. So I was asking these guys, like, I mean, The Sound of Music, really? It's huge in Iran, huge. So all these kind of hard-bitten old Iranian diplomats and, frankly, regime functionaries are going off to do their Sound of Music escapade.
They got there in the end, and Iran said so long, farewell, avida zain, good night to most of their nuclear enrichment capacity.
This moment has been a long time coming, and we have worked very hard to get here.
I believe this is a historic moment, and it is an important achievement for all of us.
So what did this deal mean for Iran's nuclear program? Okay, I'm going to need to shorthand a little bit of nuclear physics here for you so that we can get back to the geopolitics. It won't take long. This ain't a nuclear physics podcast. The uranium you dig out of the ground is useless unless you enrich it, which basically involves turning it into a gas and spinning it in centrifuges. The longer it spins, the more powerful and scary it becomes.
They could enrich to weapons-grade uranium, which would be sufficient for producing a nuclear weapon.
The way we measure the power of the centrifuges is with a standard unit called separative work units, or SWUs. In 2013, Iran had a capacity of about 14,000 SWUs per year, which is minuscule. Not even enough to power a single nuclear power plant reactor. To put that in perspective, other nuclear-armed countries have SWU capacities of several million each. But 14,000 SWUs is enough for one particular thing.
It means that the timeline for Iran being able to produce a nuclear weapon, if they were to decide to do so, is significantly shorter.
The more SWUs they have, the shorter the timeline becomes.
The US President, Barack Obama, believes Iran is about a year away from building a nuclear bomb.
Iran could be just 6 months away from achieving the 90% level needed to make a bomb.
World leaders talk about weeks and months, but really what they're talking about is SWUs. Iran has this many SWUs, and that means they could enrich enough uranium to build a bomb
within 3 months.
Only a few months, possibly a few weeks.
So, the 10-year deal struck between Obama and Rouhani was mainly about pushing that timeline out by cutting Iran's SWUs to around 4,000. Secondly, Iran had to get rid of 98% of the uranium they had already enriched. And thirdly,
before sanctions are lifted, there must be proof of compliance with the International Atomic Energy Agency, given unrestricted access to nuclear sites.
IAEA inspectors were allowed to basically sticky beak wherever centrifuges were being operated or stored. In exchange for this, sanctions on Iranian oil exports would be relaxed.
This deal demonstrates that American diplomacy can bring about real and meaningful change. Change that makes our country and the world safer and more secure.
Now, as you may be aware, there were some critics of this deal, and one of them was particularly vocal.
I've been doing deals for a long time. I've been making lots of wonderful deals, great deals. That's what I do. Never, ever, ever in my life have I seen any transaction so incompetently negotiated as our deal with Iran.
From the moment the deal was signed, presidential candidate Donald Trump said incorrectly that the deal simply amounted to a transfer of cash from America to Iran.
So, they rip us off, they take our money, they make us look like fools, and now they're back to being who they really are. They don't want Israel to survive.
Speaking of Israel, another particularly vocal critic of the deal was the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
By not dismantling Iran's nuclear program, in a decade this deal will give an unreformed, unrepentant, and far richer terrorist regime the capacity to produce many nuclear bombs. What a stunning, historic mistake.
The core of Netanyahu's problem was that the agreement treated the Iranian regime as a legitimate government, something that the US and Israel had refused to do for more than three decades.
This deal will treat Iran like a normal country, even if it remains a dark theocracy that conquers its neighbors, sponsors terrorism worldwide, and chants death to Israel, death to America.
Even a perfect deal would not have satisfied Netanyahu. And as everyone involved readily admitted, the deal was not perfect.
We are reaching an agreement that is not perfect for anybody, but it is what we could accomplish.
I mean, I've never met the perfect trade agreement or the perfect diplomatic agreement. Perfect is rarely on the diplomatic menu.
The deal was basically just a pause button for Iran's nuclear enrichment program. It didn't dismantle it, it froze it in kind of a weird state. 4,000 SWUs of capacity is way too much for medical research purposes, but way too little for a nuclear power station. Plus, Iran still had thousands more centrifuges sitting in storage, ready to be spun up whenever the deal expired. The deal didn't do anything to prevent Iran from doing all the other things the rest of the world would rather they not do, in particular funding terrorist groups like Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis. And with the sanctions lifted and oil revenue flowing in, Iran had much more capacity to do just that. But according to Burns, Sullivan, and Obama, this deal was better than nothing. The problem was, a lot of people didn't agree with that assessment, and one of those people became the president.
We have terminated a terrible, terrible deal that should have never, ever been made, and we will be putting on among the strongest sanctions that we've ever put on a country.
Israel fully supports President Trump's bold decision today to reject the disastrous nuclear deal with the terrorist regime in Tehran.
Trump withdrew from the deal in 2018, and within 2 years, Iran had dusted off those centrifuges in storage and had 15,000 SWUs of enrichment capacity spinning, more than there had been before the deal was struck. Iran blocked IAEA inspectors and rushed to expand its enrichment capacity and stockpile of enriched uranium. By mid-2025, Iran had 35,000 SWUs, more than double their previous capacity. By June 2025, Iran had 440 kilograms of enriched uranium, and the capacity to turn that into roughly 10 nuclear weapons in around about a week. It was very clear that American leverage over Iran was decreasing, and those
strongest sanctions that we've ever put on a country
were losing their effect because Iran began covertly selling its oil to China. It was clear that something needed to be done before the situation got out of hand. So our old friend Abbas al-Araghchi was invited to travel back to Oman to talk with the Trump administration about a new nuclear deal. This wasn't his first rodeo. You might remember him from such nuclear negotiations as the Obama administration's back in 2015. He was the guy at the Waldorf Astoria ignoring the picture of the Shah. He was also in Vienna, although I can't tell if he actually went on the Sound of Music bus tour. Araghchi had climbed the mountain of Iran's foreign ministry and was now in charge of it. And so he was Iran's best person to negotiate another deal. He started meeting with Donald Trump's representatives, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, in Oman. But partway through that process,
Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and totally obliterated.
US and Israeli jets flew into Iran and bombed the enrichment facilities that Araghchi had spent more than a decade negotiating over. He was stunned.
They had perhaps this plan, and they just needed negotiations, perhaps, to cover it up. We don't know how we can trust them anymore. What they did was, in fact, a betrayal to diplomacy.
Despite this setback, negotiations continued. And in late February 2026, Araghchi was sitting at the negotiation table with Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner again in Switzerland when
we have hit hundreds of targets in Iran, including Revolutionary Guard facilities. Americans will never have to face a radical, bloodthirsty terrorist regime armed with nuclear weapons and lots of threats.
And yet the talks somehow continued. Araghchi has been continuing to meet with Trump's representatives to try and negotiate an end to the war. But despite multiple rounds, there's one big sticking point.
Both sides appear to remain at odds over Iran's nuclear program and stockpile of enriched uranium.
In short, a long-term deal like the one Araghchi struck with Burns and Sullivan in 2015 seems very unlikely. Finding a way for two enemies to come to a deal is a delicate dance. It's about assessing leverage, finding common ground, and building some kind of trust. For Araghchi, Burns, and Sullivan, this was a delicate, years-long process. The Americans built up economic pressure, then promised to release that pressure in exchange for Iran agreeing to their demands. The Iranians built centrifuges, then promised to turn them off in exchange for sanctions relief. Both sides carefully assessed the trustworthiness of their counterparts and came to an agreement. The first time Araghchi sat across the table from Americans, they were career diplomats who had spent decades building the qualifications, experience, and credibility required to be able to negotiate on behalf of Barack Obama. This time, he's sitting across the table from Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, Trump's golfing buddy, Steve Witkoff, and Vice President J.D. Vance, who seems to be under a witch's curse, which makes every public appearance he makes an embarrassing disaster. There is no attempt whatsoever to build trust or rapport. There's no hijinks or Sound of Music sing-along bus tours. In fact, it's the exact opposite. The hills are alive with the sound of airstrikes. Trump killed Iran's leader, bombed their military, and destroyed their navy in the midst of nuclear negotiations. Then he threatened attacks on civilian infrastructure if Iran doesn't accept his demands. Yet Trump has struggled to find any actual leverage over the regime he has declared war on. Iran, meanwhile, has blocked the Strait of Hormuz and triggered a global energy crisis, expertly displaying their extraordinary leverage over the entire global economy. Even if both sides can agree to some kind of peace deal, neither has any trust that the other side will honour it. Iran will assume that the US will return one day to attempt again to topple the Islamic regime. The US will assume that Iran will just secretly restart their nuclear program. Perhaps a deal will have been struck by the time you started listening to this episode, but now you're at the end of it, it's worth checking whether that deal is still in place. If You're Listening is written by me, Matt Bevan. Supervising producer is Kara Jensen-McKinnon. It's produced by Adair Shepherd and Pat Sunderland. On Tuesday, we're bringing you something special, part of our show that we did at the Newcastle Writers' Festival last month. It's a story I told about the radioactive incident at my high school, which led to my first ever appearance on live radio. I'm not being hyperbolic, by the way. There really was a radioactive incident at my high school when I was 14 years old. That's coming up on Tuesday. I'll catch you then.